From the home of the Codebreakers and the birthplace of modern computing, this is the Bletchley Park podcast. Welcome to the June 2014 edition of the Bletchley Park podcast. The transformation of Bletchley Park is now complete, and on the 18th of June, Her Royal Highness the Duchess of Cambridge will visit to launch the completed restoration. In this episode, we take you inside Codebreaking Huts 3 and 6, and the new Block C Visitor Centre, with the first people to see them restored to their wartime glory, the veterans themselves. We also delve into the new exhibition, Secrets Revealed, introducing Bletchley Park, looking at what it uncovers about the Government Code and Cipher School's involvement in D-Day. First, the 6th of June marked 70 years since the D-Day landings, an operation in which intelligence gleaned by Bletchley Park played a hugely important role. We welcomed an RAF veteran who'd used Type X machines to help direct aircraft in the days following the Normandy landings. Sergeant Bernard Morgan met his modern-day equivalent, RAF Aerospace Battle Manager, Flight Lieutenant Vicky Thorpe.
We're the kind of modern-day equivalent, really. And although we don't have Type X, our crypto is a little bit more outdated. We still use crypto to authenticate and also encrypt our messages. But effectively, we're doing a very similar job, so we're coordinating the air picture. And we're deployable, so we've got the Type 101 radar, and we've got the various generators, the tactical control centre that comes with it, so we can deploy anywhere in the world, a bit like you would have done. We can set up our kit as a sealed unit, and we can look at the air picture. So we can use that for surveillance to see everything that's going on, but we can also use it to communicate with forward air controllers. It's obviously passing process.
Now, what kind of machines do you have in comparison?
It's not half as interesting. It's all just computer screens. So it's very much a case of kind of boxes of equipment now. The whole kit is a bit like a kind of Lego kit, really. It all just stacks together, and we can take bits of it. We don't have to take a lot. We can take bits of it depending on what we want to achieve. Yeah, it's all a bit more high-tech.
You have a cold boot for the day, like we are, with a setting.
Yeah, we have crypto, yeah, but not with a setting, no. We don't actually
need... When you send a message,
yep.
Do you have to set a machine up like we did?
No.
Don't do that.
No. That's about all I can say on that. No, it's all done quite differently, but the principles are still very much the same.
These were in use by the Royal Air Force from 1942... and I used one from 1943 till the end of the war in Europe in May 1945. And you have a book of codes which are operational from 00:01 one day to 00:01 the next day. And you change the coding on the machine, on the drum settings there, in accordance with that booklet. But we had two machines on our unit, 83 Group Control Centre, one which we had set up for the previous day and one for the actual day, because we received some messages from the wireless operators that were a day behind, so we had to use the other machine then. You got the booklet, you set it up to the five settings, which the person who sent the message will have also set his machine up. You get the message from the wireless operators in groups of five letters. You type it out on the keyboard, which is a typewriter keyboard. And before I joined the Royal Air Force, I'd done quite a lot of typing, and it was no problem to me using the keyboard. As a result, when I went on watch, I always got the job of decoding the messages, because the other sergeants, they weren't proficient with typing, they were one-finger typers. So I always got that job. And on one watch I was on, we had 7,000 groups of five letters to decode. And when you type the message, in each side in these drums, that there was tape. The message came out in plain language that side, and the groups of five letters came out in this side, so that you could check that you'd typed the correct groups. When the message came out there, it was on sticky tape. At the side, you had a little drum with water, very old-fashioned, and you ran the tapes over that and stuck them on the message pad, and then that message pad was given to the operations officer who was in the next vehicle to ours, where they had the plotting table with the airmen moving the things around with the stick, showing where the aircraft were. And when we gave them a message, which we'd probably received either from the Army or from 83 Group Main, saying where the Army wanted the aircraft to operate, then the operations officer would move the aircraft immediately to where the Army wanted it. And we had a watch system which gave you 24 hours leave every third day. You went on watch 1 o'clock one day till 5 o'clock, and then you came on again at 10 o'clock at night till 8 o'clock the next morning, and then you came on again in the evening, and then you came on the next morning and you finished at 1 o'clock. It sounds strange in a war to have a day off, but it wasn't a day off as a way you could do anything. You were always under the rules of the unit. Before we went to Normandy, we had various exercises along the south coast of England. You'd get everything ready, and you were living in tents then, and you moved to perhaps a dozen different places. You'd be there for 4 or 5 days, and then we're off to again to another place. It was so we could get the speed of setting up when we got to Normandy, but we didn't know then where we were going. I sailed from Felixstowe on the A echelon of 83 Group Control Centre, and D-Day was put back a day because of the rough weather. So we were there at the wrong time, really, because obviously the captain of our landing craft hadn't had the message to say it was put back a day, because we're in such a dangerous place coming through the Straits of Dover. They didn't send us any message. So when we got to the Isle of Wight, which was Piccadilly Circus, the code word in those days, and then he sent us straight down to Normandy. Well, we were anchored off Normandy, 7 miles offshore, at about 5 o'clock in the morning. The battleships were behind us, firing at the French coast, and the Germans were firing back, and we were under this canopy. Well, sadly, a lot of the shells from the Germans dropped short, and the landing craft were lined up, hundreds of us, and he drops on the landing craft and he just blew them up. The beach that I landed on, when we landed, it was very quiet. They were still shelling, you know, the Germans were, but we had a dry landing in our lorry straight down the deck, and then we had a map reference where to go, and we went there and we just had to wait there. Caen was a target for the Army, but there just happened to be a German battalion outside Caen, and that was why the Army couldn't take Caen until 33 days after the invasion. As a result, we were stuck on the beach from the 6th of June until the 9th, until they constructed an airstrip at Bazonville, and that was when we moved and started the operational work then. About 10 days after B echelon arrived of the 83 Group Control Centre, followed by a week later by C echelon, and that brought the unit up to 1,000 strong, and at this little village called Bazonville. From Bazonville, we carried on then to Villers-Bocage, and then we continued about 7 miles behind the Army all the time. We crossed the Rhine the day after the Army had crossed, and then we finished up at a place called Schneverdingen, a little village in Germany. When we arrived there, it was sad, really. There was a goods train parked on the siding, and there were Russian prisoners. They had them off the train and made them dig a pit, and then they had them there and shot them all. And when we got there, all these bodies were still in this communal grave. But of course then the Army took over and they got the civilians to bring them out and bury them properly. The peace treaty was signed for Europe whilst we were at Schneverdingen. A week after, we were flown back to Croydon because we were en route to Japan then. So they sent us on a course for a more slip reading. And then the war in Japan finished then. They sent us up to Blackpool, kitted us out with tropical kit. We couldn't weigh this up. Where are we going? Oh, you're going to the Far East, because they want you there as occupation troops. There was no code and cipher then, that was finished. So we got the boat down to Bombay. When we got to Bombay, it brought us all off. I got posted to RAF Delhi, which was, you know, 2 days' ride. And then when you go to an RAF station, you get a piece of paper with all the sections on.
Yeah, you still get that.
Where you have to get, they still do that,
yeah.
Where you have to get clearance. We got to the medical officer, and he took me temperature, and he says, have you got your small kit with you? Well, unfortunately, I had to go in hospital. And he said, oh, we'll have the ambulance here. So they took me out 10 miles out of Delhi, a place called Delhi Cantonment, which was an isolation hospital, and I got diphtheria. The code book was a vital part of the job. Now, one of our four FDPs, forward direction posts, the sergeant in charge there mislaid the book. So all the books throughout Britain had to be destroyed. Of course, the sergeant, he got court-martialed and reduced to the rank of corporal. Now, another thing which nearly everybody did was kept a diary, which was another court-martial offence if you got caught.
Yeah, yeah.
But we didn't bother because the court-martial would be held in this country and you'd go to prison in this country and you were out of the war. But
not that bad then.
No.
What made you decide to type out your diaries in?
Well, for the record, for the daughter and the grandchildren.
And what do they make of it?
Where is she? What do you make of it?
Very, very proud.
What's it like to see a Type X now after all this time?
Yeah, they didn't have one here for a long time, and they didn't have one at Hendon. And it annoyed me, they got the Enigma there, but they haven't got ours there.
The German machine, but not the British machine.
That's right, yeah. But you see, it doesn't get a lot of publicity, this.
There's a chap just behind you who had a career in the diplomatic service and is very familiar with Type X machines. This is Peter Westcombe, one of our founding trustees.
Yes, I see you know the beast as well, you.
Yeah.
Have a go.
That's it. Oh, very good. I never thought I'd see one working again.
Messages decrypted at Bletchley Park showed that the deception had been swallowed whole, leading Germany to believe that the invasion would be at the Pas-de-Calais rather than Normandy. Secrets Revealed, introducing Bletchley Park, is an exciting new exhibition which welcomes visitors to the newly restored Block C Visitor Centre. In it, the story of D-Day and the importance of Bletchley Park to the success of the landings is told. I spoke to senior archivist Richard Lewis and founding member of the Bletchley Park Trust, Peter Westcombe.
The importance of Bletchley Park's role in the preparations for D-Day should never be underestimated and perhaps can't be overstated. Peter, let's be basic about this. What was Bletchley Park's role in the run-up to D-Day?
It was a link between what the Germans in Madrid were sending to the Germans in Berlin, about the false information we were giving them through our agents, and we were intercepting that link from Madrid to Berlin, intercepting the message sent by Morse. They were coming into Bletchley Park where they were being decrypted, so then sent back to London to MI6 and to the Double Cross, where they could assess how effective this false information had been and what else they could do thereunto, either add to it or supplement it, to make sure in fact they continued to make the Germans think the way we wanted them to think.
The acid test of the effectiveness of the false intelligence. Richard, can you tell us a bit about what we've got on show now in Secrets Revealed, introducing Bletchley Park, that tells the D-Day story?
Expanding on what Peter's just said, one of the most important things we've got in there is one of the volumes that contains intercepted Abwehr messages. That shows the information that Madrid was sending to Berlin, and in turn Berlin was sending to Madrid. And this allowed Bletchley Park to feed the information onto MI6, who, as Peter said, could inform their decisions about how effective the false information they were sending to the Germans was.
A good way of humanising this, a good example, is the double agent, Garbo. Now, he wouldn't have even known that Bletchley Park existed, would he?
No double agents knew of Bletchley Park. It was kept completely out of the loop. It had to be, because otherwise, if one of them, in fact, become a triple agent, sent the information back to Germany, this place would have been blown.
If they'd have known they were being watched, they'd have sent messages accordingly?
No, not necessarily. No, the point was, across it, if in fact Bletchley Park was known to be in the loop, they knew therefore their message were being intercepted. Therefore they knew that their Enigma machine must have been intercepted. Therefore not only that Enigma machine, but all the other Enigma machines for the Navy, Army, Air Force, and that also, the whole lot could have been changed and we'd have to start all over again.
It must have been the great fear, mustn't it?
It was the great fear all the time. That was the one worry in Bletchley Park throughout the whole of the war.
And I wonder if D-Day felt like a culmination of all those years' work to those people, or if it was just one particular operation.
It was one particular operation, but it was the most important operation of the way the war was turning. This was the ultimate desire of the Allies to get back into Europe. There had been the big argument in 1943, should we go into Europe in 1943, or should we stay or go through Italy? We'd won the argument, we're going to invade Italy first. Now we're going to invade Europe. It had to succeed. And that's, in fact, why it was so important that Bletchley Park kept informing the necessary authorities how the Germans reacted. That's why the information we have here is so valuable. It's raw material. It's not stuff that's been paraphrased. It hasn't been translated. The stuff we have, as Richard said, in our hundreds of books here, is all raw material from the Germans showing exactly how they thought and how they acted.
And it's what they were saying to each other. It's verbatim. It's not translated or filtered through anyone who wanted people to know or not know any particular element.
No. It was verbatim coming in. And that raw material was being translated here and going down to MI6 and so forth. Bletchley Park was the link.
And Richard, the Garbo messages we have on show, they tell that story very nicely, don't they? Can you tell us a bit more about what's in those messages?
Yes, there's one particularly that we've got on display that makes reference to there still being troops in the southeast of England. These troops weren't actually there, it's a fictitious message. But what it does do is reinforce the false information that there will be an invasion of the Pas-de-Calais, which ties up German troops away from Normandy, increasing the chances of a success at D-Day.
And that message then, of course, the response to that, we were able to see that they swallowed it.
Absolutely, yeah. The messages we've got on display suggest, as does the success of D-Day, that they were ignorant to the fact it was false information and acted accordingly, which meant it was a huge success.
And tell me about how Garbo came out of this smelling of roses.
Well, in 1944, not long after D-Day, the Germans told Garbo that they had honoured him by presenting him with the Iron Cross Second Class for his sterling work in informing them exactly what we were up to. And the other part about it is, of course, in December 1944, His Majesty King George VI awards him an MBE. So he's got medals flying in all directions, but the point is, you can see how excellent the double cross system was. That he gets an award for doing a job, in fact, which was to deceive the enemy. And they were so delighted with what he gave them. He gave them an award. You can't get better than that.
More fascinating speakers have been announced as part of the Bletchley Park Presents series of Sunday afternoon talks. Sir John Dermot Turing and the Real Women of Bletchley Park are both now sold out. But you can book now for Bletchley Park Presents Andrew Hodges. Alan Turing's biographer will discuss the inner and outer dramas of Turing's life on the 17th of August. On the 19th of October, the curator of the Metropolitan Police's top secret crime museum, Gary Ayton, will give an insight into this notorious museum, deemed too disturbing for anyone but police officers to visit. And remember, friends of Bletchley Park receive 2 weeks priority booking on all ticketed events. The transformation of Bletchley Park is now complete. The £8 million Heritage Lottery-funded project, which has restored the site to its wartime glory, allowing visitors to experience what it was like for the codebreakers who worked here during World War II, and creating a permanent and fitting tribute to the men and women whose hard work helped shorten the war and launch the computer age. Block C is now a vibrant visitor centre, and the fragile wooden code-breaking huts 3 and 6 have been rescued and lovingly brought back to life. The historic parkland, which was ordered to be retained so that the code-breakers had space to breathe and innovate, has been restored with the removal of modern-day intrusions such as car parks. So, what did the veterans think of it? We found out at the VIP previews.
Bletchley Station! Bletchley Station!
when you saw yourselves for the first time?
It was interesting because it was a lot better than I thought it would be. Really crisp and clear. And I've been here before and I've never heard the story of what happened here summed up quite so well as that video. It's quite a succinct and easy way of understanding. And I think it really gives you a good idea of the impact that Bletchley Park had on the war.
I've been here on a visit to the new C block, and I went from here to the newly refurbished Hut 6 and Hut 3, and I think they're superb. They really captured the atmosphere. You walk from room to room in the same dim light that they had to work from. You must remember everybody smoked, and the windows didn't open because they had the blast walls, and so it must have been a fog in there, a fog in thicker. And so it must have been like that. There was no heating except from a big stove. If you happened to be there, that's fine. If you weren't, you had to hope for a paraffin stove, a Valor stove, which gave out a stinking paraffin smell. But they've got them there. I think the reproduction of it is nothing short of brilliant. I went into the mansion, which I never did go in during the war, but in the mansion, the reproduction of the offices are so, again, the only word I can think of is atmospheric. They recapture the period. Everything seems to be of my days in the outfit. So I think all in all, full marks to Bletchley Park.
Thank you very much, Geoffrey. That means a lot. How does it feel to see yourself?
It's so brilliant and it's beyond what I imagined it would be. When we were doing it, it was so atmospheric, and to be here with the doors shut, and when we finished shooting, walking past a dispatch rider with his bike, it was magical, and I'm glad it's translated to screen.
And you kept this under your hat
with
your parents. What's that been like?
I'm a really chatty person, so to keep it in when I was so excited about it, it's been hell. But I'm so pleased that I've been able to bring them today, and they've been suitably impressed, so...
They look kind of speechless to me.
It was the first they knew of it. Although my two-year-old almost did splurge the details earlier on. She said, oh, we're going to see Mummy, we're going to see pictures of Mummy. And so I went, ignore her, she thinks there's going to be rides. So thankfully they did, on this occasion, ignore her.
How do you feel about what you've seen so far, and having seen behind the scenes and what it looked like a few weeks ago?
My dad, when we told him we were coming today and we were bringing the children, had sort of said, oh, I don't think there's going to be an awful lot to interest them. And I sort of said, well, you might be surprised, they're doing something quite interesting there from what a friend at Bletchley Park has told me. And they really do get a taste of it. So I've given them a very basic outline of what went on. And they know from films, like we watched The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe, about evacuees and things like that. So they know enough. But this just, it brings it to life, and it really is something pretty special.
Thank you, that's lovely. So there must be a vast difference to see between when you got involved with Bletchley Park and now.
Yeah, and I think today signifies the ability to see real tangible difference on site of lots of things that very much go unnoticed. Great services, great car parking, a great way to come into the park, a real statement. And I think for the first time we've got a real start to the Bletchley Park experience when you arrive here. And the atmosphere you get when you stand in here today fulfills all of those many years of planning and sitting around tables and gaining funding and things like that. To actually see today us open, welcoming guests through the new entrance building, and hopefully them then being able to set out on their journey around Bletchley Park and really get the most out of it.
Does it feel like job done, or do you feel like this is a beginning?
No, there is a job done in the form of people can see there is a tangible move forward now with a real solid commitment that to Bletchley Park will be here forever to be able to tell the stories. But it is only the start of that journey, which has got many more stories to tell yet, many more areas to renovate. But we've very much put a very strong marker in the ground today, whereby we've got the start of the next phase of process underway.
What do you think?
It's amazing.
It is really amazing. It just completely blew me away. Just coming in here and seeing the wide open space, I don't think it really prepared me for going in to the rooms. And it's the small touches. It's like the display cases, like the diaries, And also, like, just payslips and, like, invitations to come to Bletchley. It's all those small details that when you get surrounded by the big picture that get missed, that get forgotten, that get fallen through the cracks, and that, I think, is done to perfection. And also, I especially love, you go in there, and I saw the sign for the stations, and then turn around, and it's like a carriage. You stood on the station outside, and it's just those little things. And then, of course, there's the interactive tables, which are just going to be fabulous for the kids. Seeing how the Enigma works that way, it's going to make so much sense to people. And then you can listen to a message, and then you can go on the Typex, and then you can do a translation, and it's all there in front of you on the screen. And I just think it just adds that interactive thing that's just been kind of missing. And also seeing the huts for the first time, you know, having peered through the windows and seeing sort of like dilapidated, fallen through floors and running away when I thought somebody was looking at me, and just being able to go in there and wander around the corridors and seeing the interactions and the filming on the wall and the desks. I've taken so many pictures of pieces of paper and typewriters. And as a researcher, what I wanted to do is look through people's eyes, and I think that's what we're getting to now, and that's amazing. I think it's brilliant, and I recommend everybody come and have a look at it.
This is extraordinary. What's been going on here, I have to say, it's quite amazing. If you had come here 20 years ago, you would have seen ramshackle huts falling apart, derelict concrete buildings, and these are of really huge national importance, these buildings, because these are the buildings in which the code breaking actually took place during the war. They're historical artefacts in their own right, and it's really, really delightful to see them being brought back and restored for the nation so that people can actually enjoy them and see how they were when the codebreakers worked in them.
There aren't many places, are there, where you can go and learn about the history of something where it actually happened?
No, and actually the significance of what happened here is something that perhaps in danger of forgetting in the good news story about the restoration, because actually what the significance of this is in terms of the strategic and tactical influence that the work the codebreakers carried out had on the course of the war. Sir Harry Hinesley, who wrote the official history on the use of intelligence in the Second World War, said that in his opinion the work done here at Bletchley Park had shortened the war by 2 years, and that's to do with things like deceiving the Germans into believing that the Normandy landings were actually going to take place in the Pas-de-Calais, and so half of the German troops were actually in the wrong place, and the contribution that Bletchley Park made to that was pretty significant in actually convincing Eisenhower that it was safe to cross the Channel and land in Normandy, because we knew that Hitler had been deceived. And that's just one example, but the code breaking had actually started to have tactical and strategic effects right from the very beginning of the war. Even in the Battle of Britain, for example, it was possible for the RAF to know when the raids were going to happen and where they would be targeted because of Enigma decrypts that were coming out of the very small operation that was happening here at the time. So this is a hugely significant place, and it's great to see it put back to something approximating to what it was like in the 1940s. One other thing that I think we ought to keep in mind as well is that Bletchley Park's about so much more than just restoring old buildings and, if you like, being a museum about what happened here in 1940s. Of course, that's really important, but there's other things that we do here which I think people are perhaps less aware of. But we can't just preserve Bletchley Park in aspic. That's not what it's about. It's a living, breathing place. So we do an awful lot of other things here. I mean, we have a very important role in education, for example, and personally, I'm very interested in that. We're setting up a thing called the Turing Education Officer, which is designed to help bring the contribution that the thought and the ideas that Bletchley Park had, which are relevant to today's STEM educational programme. That's one of the things that we're doing. And also, we're going to have a very exciting exhibition here, which will open later this year, which is all about cyber security, which is something, of course, Bletchley Park essentially invented the way in behind people's firewalls, and it's very important to bring to a wider audience the importance of cyber security and what you can do about it, keep yourself safe. So we think we've got a continuing role and continue to be relevant well into the 21st century, and we're not just a historical site.
Bear in mind that I wasn't ever working in a hut. I am still very impressed by the way that they've been renovated, because the atmosphere is there and the sense of the very difficult working conditions.
And I guess it's the same sort of furniture and things like that,
absolutely,
that you would have had where you worked.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Tables and chairs, yes, all very basic.
You wouldn't have been allowed in one of the huts if
no,
you didn't
I
work
wasn't,
in
there, because, and that was the maddening thing. I had a friend who worked in here. She was a wren, and I used to wait for her here outside lunchtime, and I was not allowed in, come hell or high water, especially high water. So that's really, you know, it's not very helpful, because I didn't ever work in a hut. I worked in Block F, which is now demolished.
Yes.
And the rest of my time was in the mansion.
What did you think of Block C?
Fantastic.
It is brilliant, isn't
Absolutely
it?
Fantastic.
Do you like the way that you come through the carriage doors
yes,
of a train
yes,
as if
yeah,
you're arriving?
It is. It's brilliant. I think it's beginning to rain. Shall we shelter?
Yes.
I don't want to have to get my plastic hood out, because I hate them, but I don't want to get my hood out.
So I can
sure.
Camp in
oh.
one of the rooms and
okay.
chat.
It may not be much, but it certainly is raining a bit. Now, I mean, just imagine working in here. It would have been very depressing working in here, wouldn't it?
Very low light levels,
yes. Yes,
yes.
I think you probably did better than your friend, Betty, working
in the mansion. Oh, I did. I mean,
it was
jammy for me. Absolutely wonderful. The only thing was that we had open wood fires and they had central heating here, but we didn't. And very often in the middle of the night the fire would go out and it wouldn't be relit. Oh, yes, these awful chairs. The light's terrible, isn't it? For working in them.
Was it this dark in Block Air for?
No, it wasn't, because that was purpose-built quite late on.
Was it all fluorescent lights then? Or?
Yes, the strip lights, yes. No, that was much more comfortable than these huts. Mm.
And what was the best to work in? Was it the mansion, was it Block F, or was it the Pentagon?
Well, without being disloyal to my country, the Pentagon. I mean, obviously, it was much more modern.
It was literally being built, wasn't it? Or just
oh, it had just finished. It had been up a few months, I think. Yeah.
You were one of the first people in?
Oh, I don't think so. No, I think it was pretty well established by the time I got. I didn't go till 45, you see.
I think they probably got it up and running ready for you.
Me and 32,000 other people.
I think they've done a really good job of recreating the atmosphere, like all the accessories and all like the small touches, and like the cigarette packets and things like that is really authentic. It's as if you've just walked into their office as it is.
What do you make of what you've seen today?
Well, I absolutely loved it. As soon as you come in, you get to feel the place. It's got a fantastic atmosphere. And it's just wonderful.
All right, you thinking you're local to Bletchley?
Yeah, we are.
So what does it mean to you? Because this is a really important part of Bletchley's history, isn't it?
Oh, I'm really proud. I'm really proud of this place, and I'm really glad it's getting the attention it deserves now.
It should have got a lot more recognition over the years.
What do you think of it today?
It's actually quite good, because last time I came here, I didn't see all of this.
The actual museum's actually displaying a lot more now.
What's been the one thing that stood out for you that you've seen today, Georgia?
The typewriters. Because Granny told me that you have to tap really hard on them.
On the old one, you
know. Total, I'm not that old.
The amount of detail and the amount of research that must have gone into this display, I'm very impressed. What more can I say?
I don't want to put words in your mouth, but it strikes me that there must be a huge difference between what you can see today and all the different stages of development that you remember over the last 23 years nearly.
Oh, yes. I mean, when I first came here, we were only open once a fortnight on Saturdays and Sundays. And all the huts were completely derelict. And what's interesting for me is to see, for instance, inside Hut 6. Now, when I was working the bombs, I knew I was connected to one of the huts by this red voice-scrambling telephone, so that when we got a good stop, we would phone it through. But to actually see the inside of Hut 6 and listen to the facsimile of the people saying, oh, we've broken in, and jumping up and down. You know, in those days, it was just an impersonal red telephone. But in fact, there were real people at the other end of that phone, and this is where they were, in these dingy, dusty, boring rooms. And we, as bomb operators, thought our machine rooms, where we had the bombs, were dingy, dusty and dirty, but they were palatial in comparison to those dark, very sparse rooms in Hut 6. I mean, yes, they had a lovely place to go when they got out of the hut, but within that, the working conditions were even more miserable than ours were, and that's quite an eye-opener.
And is that the first time you've really been able to get a sense of that?
Indeed, because we never knew what went on. I mean, that was the whole deal.
You didn't go anywhere near it, did you?
No, nobody knew. I mean, it's very probable that those first people who were breaking codes when the only few bombs that we had were in Hut 11, they also had to phone their stops through on a voice scrambler. They didn't know it was going to a hut across the pavement. And maybe the people in Hut 6 didn't know that their stops were coming from across the pavement either.
Having told this story in lots of ways to lots of different people for lots of years now, do you feel this tells the story better than we've managed before?
When you give a talk or a story, you're only talking about your part, but then people can come out of your talk about the bomb, say if I'm doing a bomb demonstration, and they can go into that and see the other end of it rather than having to imagine it. And I think that's extremely valuable. It's a great addition to the park.
Betty, what do you think of what you've seen today?
I'm absolutely amazed. I've had to cast my mind back 73 years, and I do feel very much that all the alterations have given the atmosphere that I remember.
Give me some idea of the scale of the difference in what you would have seen if you'd come last week and what you've seen this week.
Well, very difficult to put in figures, but certainly an amazing amount.
And you've been visiting Bletchley Park for a number of years.
I have indeed, yes.
So you've seen it change quite a lot.
Oh, I have, right from the time when it was a total shambles, and now it's back to what I would suggest is normal.
Can you describe, when you went into the huts, what that felt like?
Yes, I must be honest that I didn't ever work in a hut. I was fortunate to be in the mansion, but I had friends who were in the huts, and they told me about the rather primitive living conditions, and I can see that that has all been put back to how it was. And I would suggest that the members of the public are going to get a very true image of how things were.
That's wonderful. Thank you.
In Buckinghamshire, offices are closed down, papers burned,
machines dismantled. The group of people that no one knows about or has even heard of quietly disperses, unnamed, uncelebrated. But they have won their own war, the Code War. This is Bletchley Park. It happened here.
Thanks to the staff, volunteers and veterans of Bletchley Park who took part in this podcast. For more information, go to bletchleypark.org.uk or find us on iTunes. Also, follow us on Twitter, where we are at @BParkPodcast, and join our Facebook group. Thanks to Audioboo, who make this podcast possible. This podcast is produced for the Bletchley Park Trust by MC Fontaine. Thanks for listening, and we'll have more decrypts from the home of the Codebreakers next month.